This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farah Chidea. On today's roundtable, another push for statehood in Washington, D.C. falls short, and one man's quest to get rid of the mud clouding Mississippi's reputation. Joining us in our New York bureau is Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. And at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., economist and author Julianne Malveaux, who is president and CEO of Last Word Productions, Inc. She is there with Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former deputy assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Tony.
Good morning.
Good. Nice to have you all. Before we get to our other topics, I want to just point something towards you, Julianne, if I may. We just heard from folks in New Orleans who are debating the second line issue. We're not going to re-debate that in this segment, but I know that you have roots there. How big a deal is this to you?
It's a huge deal. The issue of discretion really means that you have this filter through which someone can judge which second line parades or which gatherings are okay and which ones are not and who gets a pass and who doesn't. Those folks, this sister Tamara, who has come back and is trying to do a parade, she is a cultural warrior and she deserves to be celebrated as opposed to be penalized. And so I just literally what I've seen as I've gone back and forth to New Orleans, talked to relatives and friends, is the push to shrink the footprint, to make this the Disneyland of the South. And this really kind of adds to it. You can only have those filtered, sort of sanitized parades. No, nobody wants guns and shoot or anything like that. But as she said, in other people's parades, there have been issues and there has not been sanctions. But for a small social club, you're going from, you know, $600 5 years ago to almost $4,000 today. It's crazy. And you're literally strangling the culture through this filter of we need the money. Well, if you need the money, get it from Halliburton, where you got a whole lot of other money from.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to the topics that we have been expecting to talk about. You mentioned, Julianne, footprint, and that's a good word for the next topic we're going to go to because it has to do with your Louisiana neighbor to the east, the state of Mississippi. Let me just ask the three of you, in one word or two, literally one word or two, what do you think of when you think of Mississippi?
Southern state.
Okay.
Nina Simone has this song, I can't say the whole title on the air, but it's Mississippi, you know what.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's what I think of.
Well, the reason I mention that is in Jackson, a local entrepreneur has launched a campaign to combat the negative image of that state that's been associated, obviously, with its history of racism and other things. Rick Lucer is his name. He is the co-owner of the Cirlo ad agency, and he's dedicated $275,000 of his own money to show people a different side of his home state. Here's Lucer.
I like to say it's kind of Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story. You know, you've heard about Mississippi and our troubled past, and that's not this campaign isn't to say that we didn't have a very troubled past, and at times we were our own worst enemy. But there's a completely different side of Mississippi, its achievements, its personalities, its people. And so this was really more of a truth campaign than an image campaign.
So, Ryan, let's start with you. What do you think of this idea?
Tony, I think it's a very clever idea. I actually had a chance to view some of these ads, and you know, they play off of some of the stereotypes that people have from Mississippi. One example, you know, Mississippi, we wear shoes, and they have some of the most celebrated athletes from Mississippi.
Well, for real?
Yes. Some of the celebrated athletes from Mississippi, such as Peyton Manning and his father, Archie. And another one, Mississippi folks can write. And then, of course, they're making reference to the great William Faulkner and to John Grisham, the contemporary fiction author. So I think it's a good way to revisit Mississippi. I've been down to Mississippi several times in my life. It's a beautiful state, having traveled around, and I think it's about time that Mississippi gets a fair shake as opposed to being looked at as a poor, backward state in the United States.
It really is a very beautiful place. And Walter Fields, you know, I have a family, my wife and I, in the Jackson area, and we were just recently there. And yet, as beautiful as it is, I guess maybe it's a generational thing because I'm old enough to know some other things about Mississippi. When you're there, I had this, I can't describe it, my wife also, kind of a weird, tingly feeling. Mm-hmm. What about that, Walter?
Well, you know, one of my experiences was going down to Mississippi to do voter registration in the early 1980s, deep in the Mississippi Delta. And it was really eye-opening. And the two words that I conjure up or strange fruit. You know, you mm-hmm. can't escape your history. Mm-hmm. Coming from a state that I come from, New Jersey, born and bred, look, we have our own issues, and we'll never escape those issues. I think the best that Mississippi can do is to lead by example. You know, it still has a problem in public education. Quite frankly, it still has a problem in terms of race relations. So I think there's still a lot of work to do. And rather than do a cosmetic job in promoting the state, because really this is more about economics than it is about social engineering, because the state can be hampered economically if it's viewed as being a backwater racist state. I think the best any state can do is lead by example. Do those things that prove that you are not the state that you were in the 30s, 40s, and 50s when Jim Crow flew over your state, you know, and that you embraced Jim Crow. And I think that's the tack that I would hope Mississippi would take moving forward.
Well, you know, Julianne, one of the things that the people in Mississippi will say that they have done, to Walter's point, is that there are more black elected officials in that state than any place else. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. Let me give you full disclosure. My mama is from Moss Point, Mississippi. She was one of the first African-American faculty members at the University of Mississippi, the famously segregated University of Mississippi. And when they threw me out of two or three San Francisco high schools, I actually went to high school in Moss Point, to a segregated high school in Moss Point, Mississippi. So I got Mississippi history. Mm-hmm. And I still get those same tingles y'all get. I was actually once introduced to the people who used to own us. That did not turn out right.
Say the least, I'm sure.
Let's have a do-over for that.
You know, that truly did not turn out right. I was like, thank you for sharing that with me, and where are my motor scooting reparations? You know? But in any case, you know, I mean, I think the state has a very mixed life, because on one hand, I think this ad campaign is brilliant. You know, frankly, I'm tickled by it. But at the same time, there's so much that hasn't been done. Yes, there are more local black elected officials in Mississippi, but this is the state that brought us Trent Lott, not once, but twice.
That's true.
And this is the man who openly wishes he was still in the land of cotton and is not apologetic about it. And so at the state who always is at the bottom of the indicators in terms of education, income, poverty, et cetera. Now, a colleague of mine, Dr. Greg Price at Jackson State University, says that these indicators that put Mississippi at the bottom should be reviewed depending on how you look at it. But still, what I would have to say is that this is a troubled state. But as my mama says, I shared to her that we were talking about this. She said, well, there's down south and there's up south. And so everybody got some racial history that has to be dealt with, whether it's Massachusetts, the District of Columbia, which I know we're going to talk about, still didn't have a vote. You know, let's go to Cairo, Illinois, and some other places. Mississippi need not be defensive, but Mississippi needs to get its act together, and it still hasn't done that.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to another topic. And if you're just joining us, let me say you're listening to News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai Chidea, and our guests on the roundtable today are Julianne Malveaux, Ron Christie, and Walter Fields. Now, Julianne made reference to D.C., the issue of statehood for D.C., which is on again, off again, on again, off again, off again at the moment. Let me ask you, Walter Fields, given the activity of a congressional committee this week to throw out a bill that looked like D.C. may have gotten a step closer to having a full voting member in the House. What do you make of this? Is this just another start and stop?
Well, you know, so it's one of the many long lines of tragedies and what I consider to be one of the greatest injustices in our democracy, the fact that people in Washington, D.C. don't have a voting member of Congress. And, you know, the Republican leadership, I think, once again, shot themselves in the foot. This was a great opportunity for them to demonstrate that they are a big tent party, because you had strong bipartisan support this time. You had Representative Tom Davis from Virginia has really been an advocate for D.C. voting rights. I mean, he has put his neck on the line in his own party to say that we should do this. And compromises were made. You know, they compromised by having a seat created in Utah so that there'd be some balance here. And the Utah legislature worked overtime to make sure that they would have a redistricting plan to create that seat, which is going to be a Republican seat. So, you know, the political compromises were made, and here we come again right up to the line, and we can't get it done. And there's no excuse for this. The people of Washington, D.C. deserve to have a voting member of Congress.
It was mentioned to me by someone who lives in Washington, D.C., that the issue here really isn't so much one of whether or not the people in the district should have a voting representative in Congress, but that it has more to do with the power of Congress to control the dollars in and out of the D.C. area. Is that true? And explain that in more detail for me, if you could, Julianne.
Well, I think it's both. Obviously, we want our representative to be able to weigh in on issues and to have a vote. But there is a district operations committee that basically has a veto over legislation that comes out of the D.C. City Council. So that is another issue that hasn't been dealt with in any of this, and it still is a governance issue. It's highly ironic, Tony, that we're running over to Iraq because we want democracy there, but we cannot have democracy a stone's throw from the nation's capital. The people of the District of Columbia have voted for things, legalized marijuana, for example, and then the Congress has said, no, y'all can't have that. Well, they can't say that in Utah. They can't say it in California. They can't say it in Montana. So we still remain a colony. And it's fascinating that, you know the district is going to go Democrat for now. It's gentrifying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's mostly black. Although it's gentrifying. And so there's a subterranean racism up in there. These black people don't know how to govern themselves. And so at some level, it's very frightening that given, as I think Walter's got a wonderful point, the opportunity for Republicans at rapprochement that would be rebuffed is important. But let me say this in fairness. Democrats didn't do it under Clinton either. Mm. So, you know,
I see your point.
Right. Very point well taken. And let me just say this, Tony, because I understand what my colleagues have said. I'm a lawyer. I was taught to practice law here in the District of Columbia. I studied for the District of Columbia Bar, and I'm admitted to practice law in the District of Columbia. One thing I would say to you is that when Washington, D.C. was created in 1790, if you look back at the federal city that Washington did not want to refer to as Washington, D.C., he referred to it as the federal city. The enumerated power in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 19 of the Constitution gives the United States Congress direct authority over the District of Columbia. I have great sympathy for Washington, D.C. citizens who say that we should have the power to vote. But unlike a state, which Washington is not, it is a city. It is not a territory. It is a city. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you look in the middle part of the 19th century, Washington, D.C. was a city comprised of four different districts.
Wait
a second. I didn't interrupt you, Julianne.
One second. Just for the record.
Be legal. Let's not be political. Let's look at the Constitution. People in the District of Columbia were not allowed to vote for president until the 23rd Amendment was passed in 1961. That allowed people the opportunity to vote for president in 1964. I say all of this to say that from a historical perspective, the District of Columbia is a city. It has a special status within the United States. And in fact, I think the best way to go about changing the status of the District of Columbia to allow representation in the House and in the Senate would be to change the Constitution.
Yeah, but that's not likely to happen, though, is it?
Wait a second. It's not likely to happen. How can we say that? The last time that opportunity came was in 1978, and it expired in 1985. I think rather than saying that we should have a vote to pass to allow people to vote in the Congress coming out of the House of Representatives, I think that's a false choice. It is not constitutional in my view as a lawyer, which I'm not sure if my colleagues here are not. Let's have an honest debate.
Hold on. You can finish your point, but I know you're not suggesting that because we don't carry bar cards that our points of view may not be valid.
What I'm suggesting is, in fact, this has been turned into a political argument. What I'm suggesting is that we should have a fair debate in the Congress about the constitutionality of the District of Columbia and whether or not we should have an amendment. That's my
point. I don't know where he's been, but there's been that debate. The constitutional scholars have weighed in for three decades on this issue. There are numerous constitutional scholars, not lawyers, constitutional scholars have already ruled in this issue. And that's why Congress is at this point, because Congress has gotten past that point. They understand that they have the latitude to do this if they have the will to do this. So we've been through the constitutional arguments on whether or not D.C. citizens can have the right to vote through a voting representative of Congress. And this is political, because for decades, this has been about whether or not D.C. would go Democratic, which would be an advantage in the partisan scheme of Congress. So let's not sit here and act like these debates haven't been held.
Let me throw this in, Julianne, then you can respond to it. It seemed as if the issue that you are just now raising, Walter, would have been dealt with because of the involvement of the Republicans from Utah. And yet it still it still wasn't able to go forward. Go ahead,
It
Julia.
Couldn't have got to this point if they hadn't been dealt with.
You know, but let's be clear. I mean, my pastor, Reverend Willie Wilson of Union Temple Baptist Church, said that people are looking ahead. And when you look ahead, you see the tipping of the district. And all of a sudden, people want to talk about it because the district is likely in about 10 years to be more white and possibly more Republican. But that's not the point. You know, Rob, I don't have to have a JD to have humanity. And I resent the notion that you can throw out article this and constitution that with, you know, and I can
go. It has nothing to do with humanity.
No, I didn't interrupt you either.
Yes,
and
you
so,
did.
So you know what? Yeah, what you got all the JDs in the world would not deal with the fact that the District of Columbia per capita sends more people to the military service. The District of Columbia per capita sends more taxes to the United States than it gets back. The District of Columbia per capita is a slave on the nation's plantation. And the fact is that the District of Columbia has a right to vote. As Walter says, this has been debated, and more debated. It is unconscionable to be running over to Iraq, to be running to Afghanistan, beating your chest on the drum of democracy, but you can't have it here at home. And the bottom line is, even the Utah compromise is polluted, but it was a compromise that people were willing to deal with because they understood the partisan realities. And even given that,
Julianne,
let me jump in to say
to all of you, because this obviously is a very enlightening and certainly an interesting conversation, but
Absolutely.
We don't have time. We don't have time to resolve
it. You mean I can't fix it?
No, you can't fix it. The
we'll
question is really quickly whether or not you think they will be able to continue the discussion, and if there is a realistic possibility of something being done. We've got 10 seconds. Julianne, yes or no? Realistic possibility?
In the next Congress, I think that Pelosi has a mandate.
That's not a yes or no, Julianne. A yes
or
no.
Come on now.
We don't have enough time. Ron, yes or no?
Yes, I think Pelosi will bring that up and that debate should be had in the Congress.
And Walter?
Yes.
I really do appreciate all of your input. Walter Fields, the CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Ron Christie, Vice President of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. Former Deputy Assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney. And economist and author. And from New Orleans, Julianne Malveaux, who is President and CEO of Last Word Productions. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Tony.